It was Olympia Brown who said that she wished she could preach to the men and the women of her congregation separately. To the men, she would preach a Christianity of kindness. So think all those hymns about Jesus, meek and mild. Think all those turn the other cheek biblical stories. To the women, on the other hand, she wanted to preach a more muscular Christianity. Think Jesus and the money changers in the temple, or Jesus arguing with the Pharisees. And she worried that since she couldn't, they each heard the sermon they expected, not the one they needed. I never got it before. I get it now. This week I learned exactly how she felt. Not that my topic has anything to do with Jesus or gender. I had set myself the task of asking us to think together about privacy, the self, and the web. Now, I know some of you in here may hear those words and think immediately of Eric Snowden, of the NSA, and your own questions about the survival of the Fourth Amendment in this, our digital age. And you may have come this morning hoping for some prophetic words. Get ready. I'm about to disappoint you. Now, personally, I'm cynical enough to believe that governments will always push the boundaries. And I'm also hopeful enough to believe that in democracies, at least, they will experience enough pushback from the people that they'll stay in line. And while it seems to me that 9/11 sent our culture into a fear-induced lack of forethought, stunning for its duration, I still have confidence that there are sufficient forces within our democracy to, in effect, guard the guardians. In time, our culture will create healthier norms for all our new technology. And in time, and probably with a different Congress, we will have better laws. But if those words on the sermon title made you think of search engines and filter bubbles and the data mining that business can now do just to target you more precisely, getting the biggest bang for their advertising buck, well, again, I'm going to disappoint you. If it's a mistake to preach politics from the pulpit, I can't imagine preaching economics is any better a choice. And if you think I'm going to go on about the realities of social media, which you all might hate or love, or be happy you know too little about to hate or love it at all, or if you think I'm going to talk about how these days you can learn anything you want, and I mean anything, from places like these, this won't be the sermon you expect either. What I want to do this morning, and what I'm going to try and do in enough time to get us out on time, is to urge us all towards the questions we need to consider. And yes, I'm afraid it's questions only, for this subject is way too new for all of us. There hasn't been time for true prophets or new philosophies to arise. And as we consider this topic, we need to recognize that there really is a generational divide here. Now, which generation you belong to has a little bit to do with the age of the paper on your birth certificate, but not completely, not at all. For when you plugged in to this new world matters just as much. Here's a quick timeline. What do you remember in it? When did you wake up and plug in? 1969, CompuServe starts and dial-up begins. But it wasn't until 1971 that the very first email got sent. Ray Tomlinson sent a message to himself. It was a test. He doesn't remember what it said. By 78, the bulletin board system began. In that same year, the word trolling was invented. Flame wars started and computer dating was born. Then comes Prodigy and AOL. But it wasn't until 1985 that Tim Berners-Lee started working at CERN. In 1993, the World Wide Web had been invented, and CERN gave that technology to the world for free. 1994, we get GeoCities, Yahoo. The web by then has 1 million sites, and it's called the Information Superhighway. Blogging, an instant messenger begins. By 98, there's Google. By 2001, it's Wikipedia and iPods. A year later, Friendster, the first social networking site, is launched. 2 years after that, there's MySpace, LinkedIn, iTunes, and 3 billion web pages. In 2004, a college version of Friendster begins for students at Harvard. It's called Facebook. A year later, YouTube cranks up. Then comes Twitter, with those 140 character messages called tweets. And in 07, the iPhone is released. Smartphones change our lives. In 2009, Twitter first breaks a very real news story. The tweet, there's a plane in the Hudson. I'm on the ferry going back to pick up the people. Crazy. See how much you can say to the world in 144 characters. Unfriend becomes the new Oxford Dictionary Word of the Year, and a quarter of the Earth's population uses the internet, which by then has somewhere between 27 billion and 58 billion web pages. They change so many times in a day, no one can count. By 2010, the Democratic National Committee has to hire a social networks manager to oversee President Obama's Facebook, Twitter, and MySpace accounts. And last year, there were 213 million Americans using computers to access the internet. 52 million got it on their smartphones, and 55 million found it on their tablets. More than half of the adults aged 25 to 34 were using social media at the office. Some, of course, were just goofing off and checking up on their friends, but many were working. A third of young adults, 18 to 24, say they use social media in the bathroom. Facebook this year has 1.11 billion, billion users. Twitter has 500 million. There are 156 million blogs as of last week. Blogs, online videos, and podcasts have joined banner ads as staples for marketers. And astronauts tweet regularly from the International Space Station to the whole wide world. Now, historians might count this new age we find ourselves in as nearly 50 years old. But what about you? When did it become real for you? Many of us might start in 1993. With the invention of the web. And there are some in this room, I know, who've been waking their way in this virtual reality for nearly all of those 20 years. but most of us have not. We aren't first adopters. In fact, not all of us have smartphones, and many of us feel not quite as smart as the phones we do have. So here's my question. Who are we in this new world? Are there ways that we can shape it? Or is technology shaping all of us? I'm sure that in the next 10 to 20 years, all these events on my timeline will become old hat, as interesting as history from the 16th century, and that we will, in fact, learn how to manage the technology that now amazes and frustrates and makes so many of us anxious. That we will, in time, learn how to make our way through its dangers and delights. But to do that, there are questions we need to ask ourselves. For the new cultural norms that must arise can only come from me and you and conversations that aren't wired at all. We created a postal system in the 18th century. And before there were any laws, people figured out what the norms should be. You don't open anyone else's mail. It came about because people argued with their neighbors who had. The norm was established way before the laws were ever written. And many of us, the non-engineers and non-geeks, who started using email way back, took it as if it were an extension of real mail, thinking it was a familiar way to do that same old thing. We didn't know enough to make our analogy precise. For given the structure of the internet, emails are way more like postcards than letters. And despite all the disclaimers at the bottom of some of them, there is no way to ever seal them up. There's nothing like a registered letter on the web. No way to keep them from falling into the wrong person's hand. And many of us are only realizing just now that the best protection of our privacy was the fact that most people weren't interested in what we had to say to our college roommate or our cousins across town. And in the beginning, the government was just too inefficient or incompetent to be much of a threat. But now we know that the technology has changed. And as a society, we are facing large and great challenges. We will need to find a way to curb it and protect the privacy we love. Who guards the guardians? We will need new answers to that question. I have none, and I'm not sure you do yet either, for this is all too new, all too raw. But I do know that answering that question means asking ourselves some questions of our own. For the technology which now frightens us has grown through our own hungers and desires. It's grown because we all want access. Face it, it's exciting, satisfying, strengthening, even if it's sometimes frustrating, to look up anything. There is an enormous power in being able to educate oneself in any field at all. TED Talks, the university on iTunes, are all ways to satisfy our curiosity and grow our own intellects. Yeah, we need to get savvy about the difference between the academics and the advertisers. And it will take all of us some time to find the most trustworthy sites and develop confidence in our own ability to know the difference between a fact and a factoid, which, contrary to what it says on the internet, is not a little or trivial fact, but an invented fact, believed to be true because of its appearance in print. Knowledge, for its own sake, is alive and well on the web. And so, too, is convenience. Pay your bills, make a doctor's appointment, order anything you want on Amazon.com, or pay less for it on Overstock or eBay. The data mining that has made our government so efficient as to raise real privacy concerns has come about through the habits of our own consumption. We are the ones driving it. We shop online. We reward the businesses and institutions that seem most interested in catering to us, that are geared to our particular interests and desires. If there is an app for everything, it may be because we have appetites for so much. How much convenience do we really need? Do we really want? Now, I know for those of you who are on Facebook and those of you who refuse to get on Facebook, there are many jokes about Facebook friends. And if you're on Tumblr, it can be really exciting to gain a follower or get a tweet from someone you are following. And we adults, and by adult I mean anybody who found that last sentence pure gobbledygook, are rightly concerned about what's going on here. What is it that our teens and young ones are growing up with? These friends aren't people you know or trust or have any loyalty to you at all. Friendship is not just about instant communication, not just about seeing the world in the same way. It is so much about trust and loyalty, which takes time to grow no matter what form we grow them in. The kids need our guidance. But the more I listen to them, the more I find they have a sophistication in these matters that we need to learn from as well. They know that everything on the web is forever, which many adults do not. And the kids are developing norms for what is good to post and what is not, what can be reblogged and what should not ever, ever, ever. Now I know we parents worry about the dangers of predators in this new world. And for all the scary information that our kids can find while they're surfing, the web is offering them community. I never would have believed this if I hadn't been dragged, somewhat kicking and screaming, to VidCon this summer with three of our teens. Now, VidCon is a convention for YouTubers. YouTubers are people who follow people who broadcast themselves on YouTube. Okay, yeah, I too was a stranger in a strange land. But the kids were not. The crowd out in California was about the size of our Unitarian Universalist General Assembly. But to tell you the truth, it had a less hassled, more gentle, more caring vibe. The kids didn't know each other, but they really did seem to feel that they were already among friends. And the level of helping each other out, watching over each other, made it the safest crowd of 4,000 people I have ever stood among. How can we make our way in this new world? One thing to do is to listen to those who are not so anxious about it all. Our kids. Oh, they need our guidance, sure, but that guidance will be most useful if we all can see beyond the fears we hold and come to understand the blessings and challenges they face. A life where we're all interconnected through the cloud can also strengthen our more regular adult shared life. This Wi-Fi world keeps us close to those we know and need. Last year, the Army tried to take Facebook away from soldiers in the field because they had great security and privacy concerns. It was gone for only 3 weeks. Morale fell. They reinstituted it as soon as they could. And this past week, I got a message from my UUA. I didn't even know I had a UUA. But it turns out we do. Go to the UUA website and it can find any UU member who has had some connection to the association. An old friend of the family had died in New York, and another friend of hers was trying to get in touch with my mother. My mother didn't answer the phone messages because, in fact, she was in Greece and didn't get them at all. But the friend got scared, wanted my mom to know about the funeral, and really worried that maybe she too had disappeared. She went on my UUA, sent a message to me, got it in time, told her everything was fine, the folks were in Athens, my sisters went to the funeral, and they read the words I sent. This Wi-Fi world can make a community stronger than we know. How will we face the very real privacy concerns that are now floating on the internet and in Congress? I think we do it by having conversations among ourselves about who we are and what it is we want. How much access, how much convenience, how much knowledge, how much care. I think we start by talking to each other about the communities we build and who we are. It's a conversation that doesn't need electricity. A conversation that happens between me and you, and in that most private place of all, between me, myself, and I. Who are we? How should we live? What life is it we want?